As you may recall, in my last message before Christmas, I spoke about Pharisees. And Pharisee is a label we use for people who are legalists. And by that, we mean that the main driving force for these people is to live by the rules, the laws, all of them, even the smallest of them. And when they catch people not keeping the laws and the rules, Pharisees feel compelled to point out the infractions to the offender or to some higher authority, to attempt to guilt them or to force them to stop breaking the rules. And this seems necessary because of a belief that God withholds his blessings and his positive response to our prayers when we displease him. And nothing makes God more mad than people breaking the rules. And this makes some kind of sense, since we too, at a human level, get very upset when people don't follow our rules, when people don't do what we ask them or tell them to do. The result, of course, is that Pharisees easily, quickly become the judges of other people's behavior at an immediate and at a subconscious level. And judging others keeps their attention on the behaviors and actions of people around them and away from their own behavior. If we're a Pharisee, if you're a Pharisee, if I'm a Pharisee, it's not just that we don't spend much time looking into our own hearts. It's that we become blinded to who we really are while becoming experts on the sins and the faults and the crimes of everyone else. I want to illustrate this principle with a story from the Old Testament. Israel's great King David was at a high point in his illustrious life. His army was unstoppable. They had just destroyed the Ammonites. The Ammonites were the descendants of Lot, the nephew of Abraham, who had settled in the area east of the Jordan River. Life was good for David. He was enjoying a comfortable, luxurious life in Jerusalem with at least 8 wives and an unnumbered number of concubines. The Bible tells us that one evening, despite having 8 wives and multiple concubines, he was restless and struggled to sleep. And he got up from his bed and walked around the flat top roof of his palace. And while walking around the palace roof, he saw a beautiful young woman bathing on an adjacent roof. And, moved by lust, he sent his servants to go bring her to him. The woman's name was Bathsheba, and after an amorous evening together, she became pregnant. As king, David could have had any and as many wives as he wanted, unless she was already married. And Bathsheba was already married to Uriah the Hittite, one of David's elite soldiers. And without going into all the sordid details, which you probably are familiar with if you've read the story, David had Uriah killed by proxy, and to avoid any questions of guilt coming upon why Uriah's wife is pregnant when her husband is off fighting in David's army. And as far as David is concerned, once Uriah is killed in battle, he legally marries Bathsheba the widow, and everything is just fine. But God in the story is not impressed. And God did not forget. We pick up the story in 2 Samuel 12, verse 12. It says, so the Lord sent Nathan the prophet to tell David a story. And Nathan says, there were two men in a certain town. One was rich and one was very poor. The rich man owned a great many sheep and cattle. The poor man owned nothing but one little lamb that he had bought with his own money. He raised that little lamb, and it grew up with his children. It was a member of his family. It ate from the man's own plate and drank from his cup. He cuddled it in his arms like a baby daughter. This is the Message translation. One day, a guest appeared at the house of the rich man. But instead of killing an animal from his own flock or herd, he took the poor man's one lamb, killed it, and prepared it for a meal for his guest. David was furious. He said, as surely as the Lord lives, he vowed, any man who would do such a thing deserves to die. He must repay four lambs for the poor man, for the one he stole, and for having no pity. And then Nathan said to David, you are that man. Now, David's first response would likely have been, what? I haven't killed and eaten anyone's lamb. What are you talking about? Nathan explains, the Lord, the God of Israel, says, I anointed you as king, king of Israel, and saved you from the power of Saul. I gave you your master's house and his wives and the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. You're the rich man. You're the man who had it all. And if that had not been enough, I would have given you much, much more. Anything you legally would have wanted. Why then have you despised the word of the Lord and done this horrible deed? For you have murdered Uriah with the sword of the Ammonites and stolen his wife, the only thing he had. This lesson was recorded in 2 Samuel to demonstrate several things. First of all, the obvious, that Nathan is sent there to David by the Lord because God sees everything, even the intents and the thoughts of our hearts. And even kings don't get away with anything. Justice will always be done in the end. Secondly, David was remarkably quick to observe and identify the evil done by others, as in the story told by Nathan. And was very quick both to point it out and to demand that justice be done. And then thirdly, when Nathan used this parallel illustration to point out David's sin, David failed to recognize the connection between the theft of what belonged to someone else and the theft of the lamb by the rich man. He didn't know what the story was about, which is exactly why it was told to him in a story. The point was, you should figure this out. You should see yourself in this story. Why can we not see ourselves the way we really are? And fourth, and most importantly, we too should assume that we are often blind to our own true self. We will always find it much easier to be alert to the faults and failings of others. That's just a fact of life for everyone. Why is it so hard for David to see that Nathan was telling a story about him? This wasn't about lambs and sheep and meals and visitors. It was about taking what belonged to someone else. Why are you and I so inclined to notice so quickly the faults of others and to completely miss, or more likely underestimate, our own faults? Well, the psychological answer is that the primary human motivator at the most base subconscious level is survival. And survival is not just about preserving the body of me, my flesh, my existence. It is also about protecting and defending the psyche of me, of who I think of myself to be. I need to believe that I am okay. I need to believe, at a subconscious level, that I am right, that I am competent, that I am a good person. And where others may judge me to be immoral or unrighteous, my instinct is to deny that or to justify that behavior. I believe that, or if I believed that I was a bad person, or that my psyche was warped or sick or deficient, it would be hard for me to move through life successfully. If we second-guessed everything we thought and did or said, we'd be frozen by inaction and indecision. There's also a spiritual answer to why we're so blind to our own failings. And that's perhaps a familiar passage to some of you in Jeremiah 17, verses 9 to 10. Jeremiah is speaking to the people of his day when he says, "The human heart is the most deceitful of all things and desperately wicked. Who really knows how bad it is? Or who really understands themselves accurately?" In the Old Testament, the heart represented the totality of a person's inner self, including their mind, their soul, their spirit, and emotions. It was the center of life and the source of both good and bad behavior. And Jeremiah says, who can understand their own good or bad behavior? The heart was the center of existence. It was thought to be the center of intellectual and emotional activity. It was believed to be the seat of volition. That is, it was the place where a person decided whether to submit to or resist their desires and thoughts, good or bad. All of that process, we today would probably say it's all happening in the mind or in our spirit. But in Jeremiah's time, they simply referred to it as happening in the heart of the person. Jeremiah goes on to say, "But I, the Lord, search all hearts. I examine all motives, even the secret motives, the things that nobody else knows about you, the things that you may even deny about yourself." And in the end, he says, "I give all people their due reward according to what their actions deserve." You don't get away with anything. You can't justify to God that, well, your bad actions had a good reason, or that it wasn't as bad as you think it might be. So David was blind to the truth of his own heart. This is not a matter of intelligence. It's not even a matter of intuition. Blindness, or we might call it self-deceit, is the natural state of human beings. You and I should know that we too are equally blind to the full truth of our hearts. And anyone that denies it has just proven it. It is so natural to want to justify. In an instant, David had judged and condemned another man's actions that were exactly equal to his own. Actions which David was quick to justify, initially at least, excuse, and then tolerate. David was very happy with the outcome. Notice the teachings of Jesus on this exact same matter in Matthew 7, verses 3 to 5. This is one of the most hilarious teachings most ridiculous teachings of Jesus, but it was a fairly common style of teaching for rabbis at the time to use ridiculous examples that were so obviously ridiculous that everyone could get the point very, very quickly. He says, "Why do you worry about a speck in your friend's eye when you have a log in your own?" This is not a close comparison. This is a very silly, ridiculous, obvious, extreme example. And the answer is because, as ridiculous as it seems in the illustration, we've been walking around without noticing the log protruding from our own eye. We saw the speck immediately, right? It was like glaring, glowing, flashing lights. "Look, there's a speck in your eye." And we did not notice the log sticking out of our own. We really weren't aware that it was there. That's what Jesus is saying. In other words, it's easy enough to notice the faults of our enemies. But in this teaching of Jesus, he's asking why it's so easy to notice the speck even in your friend's eye. This is not your enemy. This is not picking out the faults and looking to condemn people you don't like. This is your friend. And you're going to whack him on the side of the head with this log in your eye in order to help him and point out his fault or his deficiency. Secondly, the term speck suggests that the fault is so small, so tiny, that maybe you can help your friend or your enemy remove that speck. But maybe in most cases, I think Jesus is saying you should have ignored it in the first place. You don't have to point out everyone's faults. I know some people in some environments grew up very critical. They were criticized heavily as a child. They were told they were no good. They grew up in an environment where they heard a lot of accusations and criticism of other people. They take on that aspect themselves and they don't even know it. And most of the things that we're critical about don't really matter. It doesn't matter. Not every speck needs to be addressed. But all logs certainly should be extricated. You can't walk around with this log sticking out of your face. So Jesus is saying you probably have a bigger fault than the person that you're critical of. Jesus continues, "How can you think of saying to your friend, 'Let me help you get rid of that speck in your eye,' when you can't even see beyond the log in your own?" So what you're seeing may be a distortion. May not even really be a problem, but you think it is. And so you've got to get in there and do some kind of surgical maneuver to remove that speck. And you can't even really see it because this is covering your face. In other words, so don't try to remove the specks from other people when you have a log in your eye. Whenever you feel like judging others, always begin with a self-assessment. Ask some questions. First of all, why does your problem bother me so much? Why does this annoy me? Which values of my upbringing, of my environment, am I transferring onto you? Like, you should have things the way I like them to have. Secondly, is this really a big enough deal for me to be meddling? Many, many things we should just let go. It's not worth it. It doesn't matter in the long run. Thirdly, ask ourselves, am I guilty of the same sin? Is that why I'm seeing this in someone so blatantly? Because I hate that I also have the same struggle? Fourthly, am I seeing the big picture? I allow myself in the justification of my sins and faults to put them into a context. Well, you don't understand. I had a tough childhood. I don't have a lot of money. I don't have good health. I'm short-tempered. It's natural for me. I can't help it. We put it into a context that would explain our actions, but we fail often to do that for other people. Why are they doing what they do? Why was that person so angry today? What else is going on in their life? And usually we'll never know the context, but we have to understand there is a context, and that may explain the speck in another person's eye. And then Jesus ends with this scathing criticism. Hypocrite, he calls them. He calls us. Hypocrite. First, get rid of the log in your own eye. First. And then you will see well enough. You'll have clarity of vision to see whether you need to deal with the speck in your friend or your enemy's eye. Part of the solution lies in recognizing that our self-awareness is flawed, and that anything major, it's always good to get a second opinion. In the case of David, who was it for David that gave him a second opinion when he wasn't asking for it? It was Nathan. Nathan said from a different angle, hey, someone else did something very similar, but we'll use a different name so we won't accuse you directly. And David saw immediately what was wrong with it. Maybe for us it's a spouse, an older child, a co-worker, a good friend who knows us and is not afraid to be honest with us. If we actually invite, let me run this by you. This is what bothers me about someone. Is it me or is this actually a problem? Is this something that is just the way I'm looking at it? Is this something I should let go? Or is this something I should deal with further? And confession, I think, is the final step, especially if it's confession towards someone we've wronged or badly judged or criticized unfairly. But owning up to and expressing our own mistakes, our own faults to God in prayer is both a burden lifted, a pathway opened, and an opportunity for forgiveness and clarity. I want to end with this Psalm of David in Psalm 32. See, that's the thing about the story of David. He did a terrible thing. There's no justification for adultery. There's no justification for murder. There's no justification for taking what someone else has when you have far more than enough. But David also is recorded as a man of contrition, a man who accepts and owns up to his own faults. David sees, after talking with Nathan, when he points it out to him, David is immediately able to see that log. He's able to see that he can't blame anyone else. There's no justification at all. You can't say, well, I really loved her, or I really wanted her, and I was king, so I should be able to have what I want. There's no justification at all. It's just, I confess. I was wrong. David says in Psalm 32, oh, what joy for those whose disobedience is forgiven. And he's talking about himself. He's saying, I was disobedient. Whose sin, my sin, David's sin, is put out of sight. So that's the good news. Our own log in our eye can be removed, can be put out of sight, can be forgiven. Yes, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of guilt, whose lives are complete or lived in complete honesty. And that can be difficult, to know what living a life in complete honesty is if we're self-deceitful, if we're kidding ourselves, if we lie to ourselves, if we make ourselves seem better than we really are because we need to survive, have that psyche survive its goodness and its normalness. David says, when I refused to confess my sin, which he initially did, my body wasted away. He was physically sick because he knew what he had done. On the surface, he told himself that it was fine, but deep down inside, it bothered him. Uriah was his friend. Uriah was out there fighting for David. Uriah was willing to die for David and for Israel. And that was something that David knew, and it bothered him. And he said, I groaned all the day long. It ate him up inside. Day and night, your hand of discipline was heavy on me. Well, I don't know if it was God's hand of discipline on David. It was his own conscience eating away at him. It was his own knowledge that what he had done was harmful and deceitful and evil. He said, my strength evaporated like water in the summer's heat. Finally, he said, I confessed, spoke it out, said what it was that he had done in prayer to God, and stopped trying to hide my guilt. I said to myself, I will confess my rebellion to the Lord, and you forgave me, and all my guilt is gone. There's still a price to pay for his behavior. There's still that hole left behind because he had taken the life of a friend and the former husband of his new wife. That was still going to be there, but his sense of sinfulness and his guilt was able to be forgiven. Ultimately, when we try so hard to maintain some facade of righteousness, while hyper-tuned to the faults of others, I believe that in our spirit we're mostly trying to convince God that we're good enough, better than we really might be, hoping that our version of ourself that we like others to see, that we like to present to other people, will be close enough to reality to maybe convince God that we are that person. But God doesn't need us to convince him of anything. He knows us. He loves us for who we are. And we need to always remember that he also loves the objects of our judgment and criticism. Those people that we think aren't good enough, he loves them as well. So turn those thoughts of disapproval into thoughts of service and liberation from the curse of sin.